Welcome and thank you for standing by. For the duration of today's conference, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. I'd like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Ella Knoll. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Welcome to the National Government Services J6 and JK Open Meeting. Next slide. Remember, as the operator just informed us, this call is being recorded and transcribed. Please hang up if you object to being recorded. The NGS contractor medical directors would like, they include Ola Oadeli, Mark Durden, Janet Lawrence, Gina Mullen, Greg McKinney, and myself, Ella Knoll. Next slide. We will be looking at two proposed LCDs. The first is DL32733, microinvasive glaucoma surgery, and DL39832, botulinum toxin injections. Next slide. We are going to be starting with microinvasive glaucoma surgery, or MIGS. This is a collaborative local coverage determination revision, which is in response to an LCD reconsideration request regarding the use of osseous stent procedures for glaucoma classified as microinvasive glaucoma surgery. Next slide. There have been extensive changes from the first draft for the MIGS LCD in response to comments fielded by the A and B Medicare contractors. Next slide. Our first speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Emmerich. He is representing the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the American Glaucoma Society, the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons, and the Ophthalmic Outpatient Surgery Society. Dr. Emmerich, if you are on the call, please go ahead and let us know what your conflicts of interest are and go ahead and start your presentation.
Great, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Perfect. Thanks so much. And thank you for the opportunity to present today, representing our professional societies. Next slide. I have no financial disclosures, and I serve as the Patient Care Committee Chair for the American Glaucoma Society. Next slide. First and foremost, we'd like to express our appreciation for working with the contract medical director work group over the last year on this policy. This process has resulted in a proposed LCD that reflects current practice patterns and allows the physician and patient to make treatment decisions that work best for that unique patient. We also appreciate the addition of the section on healthcare disparities, which highlights the disproportionate disease burden of glaucoma on minorities, particularly people of African or Hispanic descent. We wholeheartedly agree that more research is needed to understand differences in treatment and that future research must include more diverse study populations. And we appreciate the opportunity to offer a couple of additional recommendations on the proposed policy so that all Medicare beneficiaries with glaucoma can receive the treatment that best suits their needs. Next slide. So we agree with the proposed coverage of stents as described in the indications of coverage. Number two, we've noted that should be subconjunctival and while phaco emulsification with a single MIGS procedure is indicated as covered in the limitations of coverage section, for clarity, we think it makes more sense to include it in the indications of coverage section rather than in the limitations section. We recommended using similar coverage language already found within the LCD and creating a separate number three bullet as shown on the screen. Next slide. As a result, corresponding changes to the limitations of coverage should be made. For limitation number two, we ask for just a slight clarification we recommend changing patient to eye because glaucoma can be bilateral. And for consistency and clarity, we recommend that limitation number 3 read phaco emulsification, IOL placement performed with a combination of MIGS procedures, e.g. cataract plus stent plus canaloplasty or goniotomy at the same time of service in the same eye is not covered. So the intent remains the same, non-coverage for multiple MIGS procedures with cataract surgery, but this language we think will be clearer to physicians and coders. Next slide. Although we understand that limitation number 3 is in the policy now, our organizations do call your attention to growing evidence showing improved outcomes and patient experience when MIGS procedures are combined. For example, in this 2023 study by Dickinson et al. In the Journal of Glaucoma, found a significantly greater reduction in glaucoma medications while maintaining similar rates of IOP reduction and low complications when cataract surgery was combined with a trabecular stent and canaloplasty compared to cataract surgery and stent alone. Other studies support the combination of a trabecular stent with goniotomy at the time of cataract surgery. And although there is currently not enough evidence for combining MIGS as a standalone procedure, we expect this evidence to grow. Adding canaloplasty or goniotomy to a trabecular stent makes sense physiologically because it addresses outflow resistance and additional clock hours of the angle. Not only can the reduction in glaucoma medications reduce morbidity and improve patient quality of life, it also may reduce costs to the healthcare system in the long run. And while we feel it's important for a surgeon, we feel it's important to have this option in their toolbox for patients who may benefit from reduced medication burden. Next slide. We appreciate the list of definitions included in the LCD because it helps everyone speak the same language. And with that goal in mind, we encourage you to update the definition of refractory glaucoma to align with the definition that we as societies agreed upon and established in our 2021 consensus statement shown here. While similar to the proposed definition, the additional specificity in the consensus statement better reflects how ophthalmologists think about the disease. This definition focuses on medical treatment, and we agree with your proposed definition that the failure of surgical treatment should also be included. Next slide. So in summary, patients with glaucoma, which disproportionately affects people of Black and Hispanic descent, need access to a range of surgical procedures, including those currently covered. Our organizations appreciate that this is generally recognized throughout the proposed LCD. For many patients, though, treatment with medications is inadequate and their glaucoma is not at a stage requiring more invasive procedures such as trabeculectomy and tube shunts. And for these patients, MIGS help preserve quality of life and reduce total costs to the healthcare system. We support further studies to investigate the indications of combining cataract surgery with more than one MIGS procedure, for example, cataract plus stent plus canaloplasty or goniotomy. We ask that carriers expand coverage when more outcome data are available. We also anticipate that future diagnostic technologies of the aqueous outflow system will allow us to target our angle procedures for improved efficacy and efficiency. We look forward to continuing this dialogue, and we will be submitting formal comments with copies of published studies on multiple MIGS procedures. Thank you very much.
Dr. Noel, are you on mute?
Of course I am. I wouldn't. thank you, Dr. Emmerich. Our next speaker is Rick Pacella, who is a director of Medicare Payer Strategy for AbbVie. Please share your conflicts of interest and start your presentation.
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. My name is Rick Pacella. I was noticed a director of Medical Payer Strategy for Ophthalmology at AbbVie. I am a full-time employee of AbbVie. I did want to mention, too, that we agree with Dr. Emmerich's statement on the, in particular, the superconjunctival statement change to subconjunctival space, probably just a typo, and this was under the indications for coverage step number two. The other information that's there has been well covered by Dr. Emmerich. We appreciate NGS's rewriting of the draft LCD, and I would like to yield my time back to NGS. Thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate that. This will allow more time for others to speak. We only had two scheduled speakers for this meeting today, so now we can go to the phone lines and get any additional comments about BL37244, microinvasive glaucoma surgery. Can we go to the phone lines and see if there's anybody who wishes to make a comment?
Please press star one if you'd like to make a comment. Mark, Latina, your line is open.
Oh, hi. Dr. Mark Latina. I just have a quick question because, I didn't get on the computer here early enough. The question is regarding endocyclic photocoagulation, and is that considered a MIGS procedure, are we still allowed to do phaco ECP combined with outflow procedures, such as any of the other MIGS procedures that are considered outflow procedures?
Sir, can I have you send that question to us at NGS, and then I will double check with that and make sure before I answer it.
Okay, great. Okay, good.
Okay,
yep.
Thanks.
Yep.
And then any other comments on the phone line?
I'm showing no further comments at this time.
All right, so the comment period ends on July 14th, 2024. Please submit any of your comments in writing to us, and watch for the changes to the draft as it becomes final and the response to the comments document. I will now turn the meeting over to Dr. Mark Durden. Dr. Durden?
Thank you, Dr. Noel. So this go to the next slide. For this portion of the open meeting, we will be discussing the collaborative multi-jurisdictional draft LCD on botulinum toxin injections. And we wanted to inform you that this policy has been developed to be consistent with the FDA-approved guidelines, as well as off-label uses and other societal guidelines regarding the use of botulinum toxins in individuals in the Medicare population. Next slide. The Contractor Advisory Committee for this topic was held on October the 19th, 2023. And this current open meeting that we're having today is part of the comment period. And that comment period will continue until July 14th, 2024. Next slide. In a rough overview of the draft botulinum toxin LCD, this draft LCD outlines the use of the botulinum toxins and lists some general indications and general limitations that will be applied for the coverage of these medications, depending on the serotype that is being used. This draft also addresses and breaks out into various medical conditions that would be considered reasonable and necessary for the use of botulinum toxins. As you know, Medicare coverage for any item or service must be reasonable and necessary. And the definition for that can be found in the Medicare Program Integrity Manual, Chapter 13. Next slide. This draft LCD outlines first the definitions of the specific medical conditions that will be addressed in the policy, and then how that diagnosis for that medical condition is to be followed. This draft LCD will also provide specific indications for the coverage and outline subcategories for the use of the botulinum toxins. For example, it will discuss the initial botulinum toxin injection indications as well as the initial dosing guidelines, and then the policy will address the subsequent botulinum toxin injection indications and those dosing guidelines. For this portion of the open meeting, I'm going to turn the time now over to some of the presenters. When each of these presenters start their presentation, I would like for them to introduce themselves and also state any conflict of interest that they may have. At the conclusion of their presentation, as the moderator, I may or may not have questions for them, so I'd be curious, and I would recommend that they be ready to answer questions if any are being posed to them at the end of their presentations. To start this, I'll turn the time first over to Mr. Zuzek for his presentation from AbbVie.
Dr. Durden, can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you, sir.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Alex Zuzek. I work for AbbVie Incorporated. So my disclosures are that I'm an employee and shareholder of AbbVie. And I want to thank everyone involved with this process of drafting this current LCD policy for botulinum toxins. I know that it takes a lot of work. It's a huge lift to get us to where we are today. And I appreciate the time to speak on behalf of both the company that manufactures Onabot A, also known as Botox, and for all the physicians and patients for which Botox has been a key part of their lives. Next slide, please. Just given the time, I want to cover at a very high level what I'll be going over today. As Dr. Durden had mentioned, the draft LCD policy is looking at drafting coverage based off of FDA-approved information, as well as what is known on disease states on some of these indications. On behalf of AbbVie, I'd like to go through some of the key details, which we've noted should require some revisions to bring the draft policy up to the level of the current Onabot A FDA-approved labeled indications. So next slide, please. Starting with chronic migraine, we have noted some key elements from the draft policy on the left-hand side of the slide as highlighted, items 6, 8, and 9. I'd like to refer to the purple boxes on the right-hand side. What we are noting here, and we will provide in greater detail in our written comments on each of these pieces of information that we're discussing today on the slides, far greater detail in the written commentary process. So with regards to migraine, we would like to note that current AHS consensus guidelines consider that Onabot A and CGRPs are first line for chronic migraine. Additionally, many of the products listed in the proposed policy are not indicated by the FDA for migraine, so we just want to bring that into consideration. And so therefore, we're respectfully requesting the removal requiring a two-month trial of a pharmacologic therapy before the use of Onabot A for chronic migraine. And lastly, for chronic migraine, statement number 8, as written, is somewhat unclear. We are asking that there's consideration on revising the exact verbiage to ensure that in practice, it is not causing any mistakes with regard to additional prescriptions or the care pathway that needs to be undertaken. Next slide. For spasticity, the item highlighted in yellow is one that we want to call to attention. We are respectfully requesting that moderate to severe chronic spasticity is removed from the current policy. The information that we are providing, and we'll go into further detail in our written comments, is that the FDA-approved label for Onabot A is indicated for the treatment of spasticity in patients 2 years of age and older. It is broad, and it's regardless of severity. Furthermore, the most recent American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation spasticity guidelines furthermore calls out that there's no level of severity for which there is a definition for which toxin or no toxin is to be used in the treatment of spasticity. Next slide, please. For cervical dystonia, we have called out the items that are highlighted in the current draft policy. We are requesting that there's rewording of the policy given the following. The American Academy of Neurology guidelines do not state routine assessment utilizing objective measurements. A differential diagnosis of cervical dystonia encompasses mild to severe neck and head postures and or associated pain. And Onabot A is approved broadly for the treatment of cervical dystonia and associated neck pain. To that point, we have provided additional information, which we will go into a deeper dive in our written comments. Next slide, please. Now on the urologic indications, first I'll cover neurogenic bladder and then I'll cover overactive bladder. For NDO, we are calling out the moderate to severe phrasing included in item number 3 of the current draft policy. We are respectfully requesting that the moderate to severe language in neurogenic drug activity is removed from the current policy. The information we will be going into a deeper dive on is that Onabot A is approved for NDO and that there's no language in the label itself related to severity. Next slide, please. For overactive bladder, we are calling out these few items highlighted in yellow. The key pieces of information that we're providing here is, again, the actual language out of the FDA approval for Onabot A with regards to the lack of mentioning of any severity, et cetera. Furthermore, the more recent AUA SUFU guidelines published on urologic indications no longer classify a stepwise fashion a first, second, or third line approach to treatment. Instead, they've eliminated that language. And so there is language in these updated guidelines from the AUA that clinicians may offer Onabot A as a minimally invasive therapy as the primary therapy before any types of failures, et cetera. So we will go in a deeper dive on that one. So we are respectfully requesting that moderate to severe and objective assessments are removed from the draft policy and that we eliminate the need for conservative and pharmacologic management before Onabot A therapy in alignment with the most recent updated AUA guidelines. All right, next slide, please. So importantly, we would like to point out to our MAC committees that the definition for spasticity has been updated yet again. So looking at what has been published in the most recent 2024 AAPM&R consensus guidelines on spasticity assessment and management, we are going to go into a deeper conversation on this in our written commentary that we would like to see the LCD draft policy update its definition from spasticity. That's all we're calling out here. We can move on to the next slide. And I'm going to actually, for the sake of time, try and bundle the following slides very rapidly. Really what we're calling out on this slide, and I'll focus only on the light blue boxes at the bottom, Dr. Durden, and if we have time later, we can go into questions. We're requesting the policy revise its statement to expand to any of the approved muscles versus just only the few muscles that have been stated in the draft policy for cervical dystonia. Next slide. For spasticity, we had noted that the current dosing, maximum cumulative dose stated in the draft policy is aged. It's a historical number. It's not actually the current approved number, which had gone up to 400 units in 2016 for the Onabot A label. So we're requesting that the initial dose of Onabot A for lower limb spasticity be revised to 75 to 400 units, and that subsequent dosing is up to 400 units. Next slide. Staying on spasticity, we also noted some of the other approved toxins that do have approvals for pediatric patients. Their pediatric dosing was included. However, our pediatric dosing was excluded. So we're requesting that the policy acknowledge that Onabot A is indicated for pediatric spasticity and that the FDA dosing guidance is applied as necessary. Next slide. For neurogenic bladder, for NDO, we're requesting that the policy allows for doses up to 300 units of Onabot A in patients with neurogenic bladder. This is supported by both phase two and phase three clinical trials in which patients not seeing improvements with 200 units were able to be escalated up to 300 units. Next slide. For overactive bladder, again, we are requesting that the policy be revised and allows for doses up to 200 units of Onabot A in patients with OAB, and this is supported by AUA guidelines and additional clinical trials, one of which is called Rosetta. It was an NIH-funded study. Again, these data support that patients not achieving benefit with 100 units, by dose escalation, the 200 units provided efficacy with similar safety profile to 100 units. Next slide. For blepharospasm, we noted that some of the items highlighted here may have been incorrectly transferred from the Onabot A label. So we are respectfully requesting that the wording and the policy reflect the Onabot A label explicitly. So if the state, the 5 units per site, not per eye. So that's the first item, number two, that's highlighted. Furthermore, it was noted that the overall cumulative dose for blepharospasm was missing in the blepharospasm draft policy, or sorry, in the draft policy. So in a 30-day period, a blepharospasm patient may receive up to 200 units. So we're noting that we just want to bring that back up to par with the label as approved. Next slide. In the preamble to the policy, we noted that image guidance is not considered reasonable and necessary for injection of botulinum toxin. That's a statement that was made. We respectfully disagree, and we'll be providing a considerable amount of evidence to support the utility usefulness of using ultrasound whenever it's available. So we request that the imaging guidance is considered reasonable for initial and subsequent injections of botulinum toxins for conditions, especially in cervical dystonia and spasticity. We will, again, provide deeper details in our written commentary. Next slide. And this is the final slide. We also noted a considerable number of ICD-10 codes that are missing in the current policy in relation to previous policies. We will again provide a greater level of detail in our written commentary, but the majority of those codes were missing in spasticity, 156 of them to be exact, 8 in overactive bladder, and 4 in cervical dystonia. And that should be my final slide, Dr. Durden.
Mr. Zusak, thank you for your presentation. I do have a question for you. You referenced the AAPM&R consensus guidance on spasticity management, assessment and management. That was the 2024 article that just got published by Verduzzo and Gutierrez recently. My question to you is, you're requesting that the removal of the severity of spasticity be removed, but the table that they used in their article, I think it was table 1A4, talks about the, and I will paraphrase, the need to mitigate for other things that cause spasticity and use medications prior to, or use medications for the management of spasticity. How do you equate or justify the removal of the language of moderate to severe when the consensus guidelines address, you know, preliminary steps that need to be taken prior to the initiation of onobotulinum toxin?
It's a good question, Dr. Durden. I think if I'm going to answer that question, I'll try my best to reflect those authors driving that consensus statement on the guidelines. If sort of thinking through what they've been going through and the process, it's that it's more of a quality life decision. It's, is a spasticity getting in the way and needs to be treated? Furthermore, there's no standardization as to which measurement needs to be used to demonstrate that the spasticity is moderate or severe. I think when we look at the approvals for botulinum toxins in the spasticity space, we note that modified Asher scale or the modified Tardieu scale is used to demonstrate a change in tonicity by the intervention, which would be the botulinum toxin. However, I think in actual real-world clinical practice, there's no standard assessment being used, for which I think it would be easy to define whether everyone is defining moderate to severe spasticity or mild spasticity, et cetera. I think it's a quality of life decision. Is the spasticity actually impacting the ability of patient to do something, whether it is something passive like hygiene care to possibly something more functional like the ability to, let's say, manage a purse or even possibly hold a hand of a grandchild. Just to use some examples we've heard anecdotally.
Okay, excellent, thank you. One additional question I have for you. There has been in the literature some discussions about using what has been termed high dose botulinum toxin injections for the management of various conditions. And each condition, obviously, is different. When you're describing the upper level dosing that you've described for the neurogenic bladder, the overactive bladder for spasticity, if you could, in your comments, address the quality of the evidence that is recommending that. I recognize you said that there's some phase two and phase three studies that have identified that. Also interested in answering a question about spasticity and particularly onobotulinum toxin, that the use of high-dose onobotulinum toxin has not received universal acceptance within the field. What is your position on that indication?
Another good question. I think in spasticity, first, I think it's defining high dose. Furthermore, I think it's also defining the use case. So I think where we see the most likely use case for higher doses, so let's say above the maximum on-label cumulative dose that was studied, so above 400 units, in spasticity, is most likely related to those patients with both upper and lower limb spasticity, or possibly even both lower limbs are spastic, and therefore the highest approved cumulative dose does not meet the needs of the patients. There is substantive evidence on this topic, and again, as you've asked, we will address the quality of this evidence from both phase four real world evidence to additional data that has been published on this type of use case. I think where, as you've called out, Dr. Durden, where there may be disagreement is how high is high or is good enough. I think what you'll see from our recommendations is, at the very least, upwards to 600 units, we believe has substantial support in what is published out there. I won't be able to comment on anything above that, as I think you'll be looking at more at case studies, case series from there.
That has been my research as well. Thank you very much, and thank you for addressing those issues.
You're welcome.
Any other comments you want to make in summary, since I took some of your time?
Oh no, I'm good. I went over everything I needed to. I really appreciate y'all opening up and giving us time to provide comments.
Thank you, Mr. Zuzek. Appreciate your time to be here today. Our next presenter today is Dr. Bersani, and so I'd like to turn the time over to Dr. Bersani to make his presentation. Dr. Bersani, you may be on mute.
Dr. Durden, I don't think we have Dr. Bersani on the line at this time.
Okay.
We're a little bit ahead of schedule, so I think we might still be waiting on him to join.
That's fine. With that, if you could shift down to slide 62, and we'll turn the time over to Dr. Mann, if Dr. Mann is here.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, perfect. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the forum here. I will start with my disclosures first. So I'm Amandeep Mann. I am the medical director for Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals. I am a full-time employee of Ipsen and hold shares in Ipsen stock. I will start with a disclaimer that this presentation was in response to MAC requests for feedback on the updated MAC draft LCD policy consistent with the FDA approved, as well as off-label use of Bont A's for the Medicare population. Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals does want to recognize and thank the NGS and CMS members for their efforts in updating the very comprehensive Bont LCD policy. Today, I don't have slides to go through, but I will walk through some key sections of the draft policy that we hope can be updated to improve access for the Medicare population and in select sections expand the coverage for Dysport abobotulinum toxin. For the remainder of the presentation, or my verbal commentary, I will be referring to Dysport as ABO, just as a short form. So Ipsen will follow up with a detailed response letter, including all relevant supporting references to be considered for the final LCD policy. Just to start off with the approved indication, the FDA has approved ABO treatment for cervical dystonia in adults, and that first indication was approved in 2009. And the second indication is in the treatment of spasticity in patients of 2 years of age or older. So these are the therapeutic indications for ABO. I do recommend that you look at the ABO prescribing information for complete details on the box warning for distant spread of toxins, contraindications, warning precautions, and adverse reactions. Just as a historical context for ABO, ABO has been marketed for over 30 years globally across multiple indications, including but not limited to cervical dystonia and spasticity. Now, just going into some of the key elements that we like to request in terms of the updates for the policy. There are six in total. The first request is to update the indication of coverage to be inclusive of all CD and spasticity patients that can be treated and to avoid restricting access to only moderate or severe patients. Our current FDA-approved label for ABO is not limited by disease severity for either indication, so for spasticity or for cervical dystonia. Secondarily, AAN guidelines for ABO is actually shown as one of the only Bont A's that has a level A recommendation for the use and treatment in cervical dystonia as well as adult spasticity for both upper and lower limb spasticity. The AAN guidelines really do highlight and do not restrict the use of Bont A's or Bont in between disease severity for cervical dystonia or spasticity. In agreement with the previous presentation, AAPMR consensus guidance published in 2024 also does not restrict or categorize the Bont A recommendations by severity of spasticity. So both of them, all these 3 points, we are hoping that you can consider as supporting data that the indications for the up coverage for CDN specificity be broadened. The second request from Ipsen would be to reinstate the on-label diagnosis codes that were omitted from the draft LCD policy for ABO. So this includes cerebral palsy, all paralysis and collegiate classification, contractures, and muscle spasms. ABO has established safety profile and proven efficacy in phase 3 registrational trials for adult upper limb and lower limb spasticity that has led to a broad indication for the treatment of spasticity not associated with paralysis classifications or specific symptomology. We also have phase 4 studies and data that is supportive, reflective of real-world usage of ABO in varying populations of limb paralysis. In addition, our pediatric phase 3 studies were done to show efficacy and safety of ABO in upper and lower limb spasticity evaluated in CP patients. And CP is actually one of the leading causes of spasticity in children. Just as a note, the reference, there are supporting references to all of the statements that I am making, so I do refer you to the written response that we will be providing to look into detail into those references. And just as the end to the second point that we did want to make is that the types of paralysis and spasticity for adult as well as pediatric patients can be classified as diplegia, hemiplegia, paraplegia, as well as quadriplegia, according to the area of the body that is affected. And therefore, we request that the codes be reinstated for the treatment with ABO. The third request is to update the CPT code title, spasticity hemiplegia, back to spasticity in group 14 for ABO-BONT A. The current draft LCD title is highly limiting and may unduly restrict treatment of other types of spasticity in the Medicare population. In alignment with the FDA approval of ABO for the treatment of spasticity, we are requesting this change because our FDA-approved indication is broad. Also, just talking to the same points for the second point that I have made, we have phase 4 studies and pediatric studies that include CP patients categorized with different types of paralysis, going beyond just spastic hemiplegia. The fourth request is to include all ABO on-label muscles, as well as update the language for ABO-BONT A dosing guidance to include all on-label ALL, so adult lower limb and pediatric upper limb dosing to the guidance there. For cervical dystonia, we request the expansion of muscles that are including levator scapulae, splenus, as well as splenus capitis, as well as longissimus. The on-label dosing for recommendation for AAL as well as PUL, which is currently missing from the draft policy, should include for AAL, it is the starting dose is 1,000 units or 1,500 units with a maximum dose of 1,500 units for adult lower limb spasticity. Then for pediatric upper limb spasticity, the starting dose is 8 units per kg to 16 units per kg per limb. And the maximum dose for pediatric upper limb is 16 units per kg with 640 units as the maximum dose, whichever one is lower. The fifth request is similar to the previous presentation, is to include the CPT code for ultrasound image guidance in the treatment of spasticity and cervical dystonia. When injecting ABO, the use of guidance technique is recommended in the FDA-approved ABO prescribing information. In addition, there is a number of publications that actually support the use of guidance and show that this usage of ultrasound guidance may mitigate adverse events and really help to visualize the injection site, the target site that you are injecting the toxin into. This data is actually also supported by our recent phase 4 study in adult lower limb spasticity, where we showed the treatment of looking at the efficacy and safety of ABO in a phase 4 study, and we actually showed that there were improved patient goal attainment in those patients that were injected with ABO using ultrasound when compared to those patients where there was no ultrasound guidance used. And this was published just recently. This data was presented at AAN as well as WCNR. The sixth request from us is to reinstate ICD-10 codes for ABO that are currently in the policy, including other dystonias, and also consider additional codes for ABOA usage in the policy. So one of our first indications for the use of ABO in Europe was in blepharospasm and hemifacial spasms in early 1990s. I would also like to bring awareness to the existing published data on ABO use in other conditions that fit under other dystonias. This includes, but is not limited to, blepharospasm and hemifacial spasms. In addition, there are data that supports the ABO use in other conditions such as neurogenic detrusor overactivity, so NDO, migraine, and hyperhidrosis, and these are also indications that are approved outside the U.S. For all of these points that I've made, the 6 points I've made, I do refer you to review the Ipsen comprehensive written comment response that will be provided, along with the supporting references for additional details. So I thank you for this opportunity to speak at this forum. We look forward to submitting our written response with Ipsen's requests and feedback, along with the data that supports the statements that I just covered today and the PI for your review, and hope you consider our suggestions in relation to ABO coverage in the final policy so that Medicare patients can have access to treatment options to manage their chronic and debilitating conditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. I have a question for you, if I may. I have, when you use the words or the term muscle spasm as one of the indications, I'm just a little surprised because I'm not sure I understand what a muscle spasm is and how it would be defined from a policy perspective.
So that is a great question. So that's referencing my second point around the reinstatement of the on-label diagnosis. So this is currently in the policy for ABO botulinum neurotoxin usage. So typically when you do inject for overactivity in the muscles, you do see the effect of reduction in muscle spasms as well. So they are defined as painful contractions and tightening of your muscles. It's just another definition for an effect that you can get with spasticity or overactive muscles. And given that the mechanism of action for ABO or other BONT-As is to reduce the overactivity, you would actually see a reduction in spasms with the treatment of ABO.
Yeah, I agree. But my concern is that the use of the term muscle spasm is too general and doesn't describe the neurologic component of what is really the etiology of the muscle spasm. So for cervical dystonia, it's a neurologic etiology. For spasticity, it's a neurologic etiology. And that's why the presynaptic effect of the botulinum toxin, it works because of the neurologic component. So I heard that the terms that you wanted to have used were, you wanted to include the cerebral palsy issue, muscle spasm, and contracture. It was early on in your presentation. I guess I'm at a loss to understand the issue of muscle spasm and the use of in contractures when that may or may not be an issue related to a neurologic condition, and therefore botulinum toxin, which is working on the presynaptic clefts, or the release of the acetylcholine, then isn't going to be effective, and simply just having somebody with a contracture or muscle spasm isn't really addressing the issue. So can you address why you would want that terminology placed in a policy?
So it's really to allow the flexibility for the treating physician to manage spasticity appropriately. Typically, we see that spasticity patients actually do not get the appropriate management until it is like they're further down in their patient journey. By that time, they may develop contractures in certain muscles or certain joints, but that does not mean that patient cannot benefit from toxin. We actually have shown evidence across Bont A that injecting even in patients that have contractures can be beneficial in improving passive function, if not active function. So we still would like our prescribing physicians to have that option to be able to treat patients that may have contractures in their upper or their lower limbs.
Okay. Also, an additional question that I have, you said that the policy may be limiting the treatment for spasticity. Could you enhance upon that statement that you said that it was going to be limiting? And I didn't know if you meant it was because we didn't articulate in the policy that it was spasticity as a result of a traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy, or some other neurologic condition, or were you making it as a general statement that it's the dosing is limiting?
Right. If I understand the question correctly, this might be referencing my third point around the CPT code title, which has changed from spasticity to spastic hemiplegia. That would be restricting for Abobont A usage in spasticity population.
Okay, so you're addressing the codes in particular, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was the titling for the CPT code, which actually became more restrictive for ABO versus being more general and aligned with our FDA-approved indication.
Excellent. Okay. Now I understand. Thank you. And Dr. Mann, anything further you would like to add?
No, I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of IPS and highlight some of the key points that hopefully you will consider once you're creating the final policy. And once again, the written response will have all those details laid out. And I do apologize for not having slides ready in time for this presentation. But, yes, open for any other questions.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Mann. I don't have any further questions, but I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today and giving us your comments, and we will take them under consideration. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before I turn the time over to Dr. Bersani and make sure that he's here, I would like to turn open the meeting to anyone that would have any additional comments that they would like to add. And so, operator, if you could open the lines to anyone that would like to make additional comments.
As a reminder, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star one. Our first comment comes from Dr. Zachary Bohart.
Yeah, hello, how are you? Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, thank you very much. My name is Dr. Zach Bohart. I run the Adult Spasticity Clinic at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. And I also work at University Orthopedics, which is the orthopedic department for Brown University Medical School. I'm also on the Corporate Relations Committee for the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, and we are working on a response to this misguided venture. I apologize if I speak out of turn, as I have never done this before. I am in a clinic, and I am not in Washington, D.C. That being said, those of us treating adult and pediatric spasticity take care of the most heavily neurologically disabled population in our country, with diagnoses ranging from strokes to multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury, and spinal cord injury. Our goal of treatment, I just want to let you know that what we are trying to do as physiatrists and neurologists is to improve upon care and comfort and level of active or passive functioning and human dignity, which is specifically impaired by spasticity. And please note there is no agreed upon definition of severe spasticity. You have it or you don't, and if there's impairing level of functioning, then we, those of us in the field agree that it is severe enough to be treated first line. The proposal to curtail the dosing of toxins and limit the use of toxins to strictly on-label use is severely beneath the standard of care for those of us who have been in this field for years and decades. We frequently use up to 400 to 600 units of Botox and similar dosing for other brands of botulinum toxins regularly, as this is what patients frequently need to sit in a wheelchair. This is what they need to have groin or palmar hygiene performed, to clean their groin in a wheelchair, to wear a hand or an ankle splint after a stroke, or to walk and transfer and progress with post-stroke physical and occupational therapy. Decreasing the dose we can use will literally tie our hands behind our backs in treating this very difficult patient population that is voiceless, that is living in nursing homes, that is living in group homes, and that is overlooked. This is strictly an issue in my mind and those who I work with of equity for our neurologically disabled condition, and it must be reconsidered for it is clinically misguided and wrong. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. If you could as well submit those comments in writing, that will formalize those comments.
I would love to. To whom do I submit it, sir?
At the end of this presentation, we'll actually give you that website and the contact information for that.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next comment comes from Dr. Bridget Walker.
Dr. Walker?
Am I off mute?
No, you're off.
Okay. I'd like to echo similar exact sentiment. I am a physician at Hartford Hospital. I'm physical medicine and rehabilitation, and I completed one of the spasticity fellowships at the Medical College of Wisconsin. There's two non-accredited fellowships in the country. And so, like, I missed the name of the physician at Tufts, but it's a very unique population. It's a very vulnerable population, and I feel like with the limitations on the dosing, sometimes we already come into ceilings of like, okay, well, it's 400, but no, it's 400 per each limb. And sometimes these stroke patients have the upper limb, the lower limb, the neck, the trunk, and you hit ceilings on how much we can provide. I think from the comments from, I think the questions was on AbbVie in terms of like the moderate and severe, echoing again from the consensus statement from AAPM&R is, it's a matter of what's a problematic spasticity. Sometimes it's mild, and sometimes you really don't catch anything doing the modified Ashworth. But functionally, while they're doing walking or transferring or sleeping, then they have these really bad spasms. And so we use these toxins to do a focal treatment in order to minimize the side effects of any oral medications, especially if they weren't able to tolerate them, and it can provide a significant amount of relief and ability for them to function. So I think that's where the sentiment comes in terms of liberalizing it so that it's not just moderate and severe, because sometimes it's just certain muscle groups, and using the expertise from our physiatry colleagues and neurology colleagues on treating it, you know, I think also the comment in terms of what's a high dose versus a low, you know, low dose. I think it's also, it's sort of, it's hard to say because 400 to me is not necessarily a high dose, but certainly talking about like 600 and 800 units, that would definitely be a higher dose in terms of on a botulinum toxin and incobotulinum toxin versus the equivalent for avobotulinum toxin. So I think similarly, just echoing the sentiments of the physiatrist at Tufts, that this is a really vulnerable population, and putting the limitations on the dosing and the ICD-10 or CPT code or ICD-10 codes for the diagnosis will really inhibit our ability to treat this already vulnerable population.
Thank you very much. I would also like to request that you submit those comments in writing so we can formalize them. So thank you, Dr. Walker. Operator, are there any additional comments, or has Dr. Bersani joined us?
I'm showing no further comments, and Dr. Bersani is on.
Dr. Bersani, this is Dr. Durden. I'm going to turn the time over to you for your presentation.
Can they hear me? I can't tell. I'm trying
now to. Now I can hear.
Oh, you can hear me? Okay. Good. Okay. I'm just getting into the website here. But, okay, I'm Thomas Bersani. I'm an oculoplastic surgeon in Syracuse, New York. I'm a professor at the State University of New York at Upstate Medical Center for 37 years. I trained at the University of Michigan with Dr. Bart Free, I think the first human to use Botox on a human for any disease, and that was for a benign essential blepharospasm. I've done a number of research papers on this disease and these treatments over the years because of my early exposure, and I was one of the first physicians in New York State to use it when it was approved by the FDA in 89. And back then, there were very crude recommendations as to how much should be given and where, but over the years, we have developed a much more elaborate, detailed protocol that is very individualized to the patient's needs, because blepharospasm is really a wide spectrum of severity from patient to patient, and we start with a low dose of maybe 2.5 to 5 units of toxin in three or four locations around the eyes, in the eyelid area. And then depending on how they respond, we gradually up the dose until we get to a therapeutic level where they can function. These patients are absolutely unable to function. They can't ride, they can't drive, they can't read, they can't work. I am proud to say that in 37 years, I have not had one patient go on disability due to this disease, even though many have asked me to put them on disability. And the reason is if we stick with it and work with them and try different dosages and patterns, we can get them functioning. We can get them seeing and doing what they need to do. And it's a really an incredibly useful drug. But the typical dose might be 20 to 40 units per eyelid in 6 or 8 locations per eyelid. So that's way higher than what is being proposed as a dose for treating this. And I think it goes back to the early FDA, the earliest descriptions of it when it first was FDA approved. And those descriptions have not kept up with many decades of clinical practice. So we are hoping that the decision of the committee will be to give us flexibility with the amount we use and the frequency with which we use it in the 2 to 4 month range between anywhere from 40 to 80, even 100 units per patient is sometimes needed to control this very, very challenging disease. I'm happy to answer any questions about this disease or its treatment, but that is my primary recommendation and request, is that we let the doctors make the determination on an individual basis, because that is the best way to gain control of this disease.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Bersani. I don't have any further questions. I appreciate your comments, and I think I understand your position.
Great. I'm glad I could help, and thank you for your asking me to speak.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you for especially coming out of surgery today to help us with this very important topic.
I agree. It's very important, and I'm happy that I was able to help.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Operator, I'd like to now look and see if there's any additional comments in the queue, and if you could check that first.
As a reminder, please press star 1 if you'd like to make a comment. I'm showing no comments at this time.
Thank you, operator. At this time, what I'd like to do is close my portion of the open meeting, but inform all participants that the comment period is still open and will remain open until July 14th, 2024, just before midnight. And all comments that have been presented here today must be submitted in writing to National Government Services. And this concludes my portion of the open meeting for the draft LCD for botulinum toxin injections. And I'll turn the time now over to Dr. Noel for the concluding remarks.
So as promised, you can send your comments to us at NGS. You can click on the public comments button on the proposed LCD in the Medicare coverage database. You can send that information to Part B LCD comments at anthem.com. Part B LCD comments are all run together and at anthem.com, or you can send them snail mail to National Government Services LCD comments, P.O. Box 7108, Indianapolis, Indiana, and the zip code is 46207-7108. Next slide. Or is that the last slide? I believe that's the last slide. We will adjourn this meeting, and I want to thank everyone for attending and participating today. Thank you very much.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.